Okay, so one of the less understood things about an hour-long podcast is that it actually takes quite a few hours behind the scenes to make. You're lining up different people's schedules, you're writing scripts, editing audio, making it feel effortless actually takes a bit of effort. That's why I want to recommend Notion. Notion is a place where any team can write, plan, organize, and rediscover the joy of play. It's a workspace designed not just for making progress, but getting inspired too, so that when it comes time to hit the record button, everyone's on the same page, or TeamSpace, or Calendar, or QuickNote, have a play around, they're all there. Notion combines your collaborations into one space that's simple and clear, and it also has some AI running in the background to help things along. Try Notion for free when you go to notion.com/squared. And just an FYI, that's all lowercase letters, notion.com/squared, lowercase. So you can start turning ideas into action. And when you use the link, you're supporting what we do here on the show too. That's notion.com/squared.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Hello, podcast listeners. I'm Connor, and welcome to this week's episode of Intelligence Squared. Today, we're joined by historian Rutger Bregman, who spoke to journalist and broadcaster Helen Lewis about his new book, Humankind, A Hopeful History. And together, they answer the age-old question of whether humans are governed by self-interest or whether deep down, we're actually pretty decent and kind. It's a fascinating conversation, and the event was part of our new subscription service, Intelligence Squared Plus. So you'll hear a lot of questions towards the end from our live audience. And if you enjoy it and you want to take part in some of our future events and ask your questions to the speakers, including our cancel culture debate coming up on the 22nd of September, you can go to intelligencesquared.com/plus and subscribe today with a special podcast discount code. Use the code podcast, PODCAST, at the checkout and join today to support Intelligence Squared and learn from some of the most brilliant minds. Now, let's go to the episode.
Hello and welcome to this Intelligence Squared Plus event with Rutger Bregman, the Dutch historian and writer at The Correspondent. His 2019 book, Utopia for Realists, was a Sunday Times and New York Times bestseller and has been translated into 32 languages. His latest book, Humankind, A Hopeful History, my copy is a very patriotic Dutch orange, is also a bestseller and is a Guardian Times and Financial Times summer read. Okay, Rutger, easy one first. What made you want to write the book?
So I think two things. The first thing was that while I was on a book tour with my previous book, Utopia for Realists, I started to get into the same situation time and time again. So the previous book was, one of the ideas in there was the notion of a universal basic income. You know, we talked about that. The notion of just giving everyone free money, a monthly grant that's enough to pay for your basic needs to afford food, shelter, clothing, that kind of thing. 6 years ago, it was a quite obscure idea. Now it's really moved into the mainstream. So in that book, I tried to show that there's actually a lot of convincing scientific evidence that this could actually work and people don't waste it on drugs or alcohol or that they'll watch Netflix all day, but they actually, you know, find a new job, start a new company. There's good evidence that it might work on a bigger scale. But then again and again, after 20 or 30 minutes of discussing this evidence with readers, I find myself in a very different debate, which was about human nature, because that's always where it ended up, that people would say, yeah, but what about human nature? Aren't people, in the end, just selfish? Maybe not like in a weird Nordic country, maybe not in Canada in the 1970s, but on average, most people, if you scale these things up, will turn out to be selfish. That's just how it works. That was sort of, it made me think that I had to go a little bit deeper. Then the second thing that made me want to write this book is that I started to notice that in so many different scientific disciplines, a new view of human nature seemed to be emerging, that so many specialists from different disciplines now have a bit more hopeful view of who we are as a species, but they often don't notice what's going on in the field next to theirs. Because academia, as you know, it's so specialized these days, is that a psychologist doesn't really know what's happening in evolutionary anthropology or in sociology or something like that. So in this book, I just wanted to connect the dots and to show that something bigger is going on.
I'm interested in your backstory. So I think, as you say, one of the really interesting things that links both that book and this book is this idea of realism, or I guess pragmatism, right? The idea that these aren't kind of crazy left-wing, like, would be lovely if we could in a perfect world kind of ideas. These are practical things that we can do. So the book, to me, seems like it's a reaction against the economic model that's dominated the West since, well, throughout the 20th century, certainly since the 1970s, whether you want to call it neoliberalism or whether or not you think that's an overused word. I think it's probably both. And then, as you say, the psychological underpinnings of that, saying, well, this is how people act rationally. But it also seems to be an argument to me about whether or not political change is itself possible, right? The idea that lots of people feel very apathetic. They feel caught in the grip of these big forces and powerless to make change. So where does that come from in your background to want to fight against all of that?
Like in my personal background, that's a great question. So many journalists are often quick to point out that my father is a Protestant minister, right? So I have a religious background in that way. I'm not religious myself anymore. But, you know, when I was 18 or 19 years old, as many people at that age, I was obsessed with the question, does God exist? Did Jesus die for my sins? I wanted to know the answers. And especially, I think I sort of wanted to become a Christian. I just needed to find the right evidence first, the right arguments, so that I could sort of convince everyone in my context who was not had the same beliefs. But then I, you know, went down that road and became an atheist. And that period of my life, I was very obsessed with the question, what is true, right? What about this dogma? What about that dogma? Does God exist? What does that mean? Like, did he create the world 6,000 years ago? Or is he like sort of an omnipresent being, blah, 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 all those kind of questions. As I became older, however, I guess I became less interested in sort of those boring questions like, is this or that true? And I became more interested in the questions, what would happen if we believe this? What would happen if we believe that? Because I also started to realize that actually the conversation I'd been having with my father over all those years, it didn't really make sense because he was looking at me and I guess he was thinking all that time that I didn't really understand religion. Because for him, religion was never really about that, about, you know, what is truth? It was about something else.
Yeah.
So that doesn't mean that I've suddenly turned into a Christian, but I think people are right when they point out that in many ways, this is a quite Christian book or a religious book that I'm interested in. Yeah, typically religious questions.
That's so interesting to me because my father is a Catholic minister. And I think when you grow up in that a kind of household, my mum was a religious education teacher, a household where people are interested in the idea of service to other people, right? And that to me is the good side of religion, the idea that there's more, I guess you say there's more on to life than getting the most stuff that you can, than achieving the most stuff that you can, than getting as much wealth as you can. That the good life is about being part of a society and giving back to other people. And do you feel a bit, because I sometimes feel a bit guilty about my younger atheism when I was very zealous about being an atheist, about, you know, going very hard on religion as the opium of the masses and not recognizing perhaps some of the community stuff, which I think I feel very much in this book about, that religion did give people, and perhaps the absence of religion, there hasn't been something equivalent, a secular version of that to replace it.
I sometimes think that the great tragedy of religion is that the most wonderful generation of believers is also the last generation, because sort of they're not that dogmatic anymore. They sort of keep the good things and they've lost the very nasty things. But then they're not evangelical anymore. They don't have sort of the power or the will to really share their truth because they're not that all that sure about it anymore. So that I think that's one of the great tragedies of religion. And I've always been interested in sort of the question, how can we take the good things of religion and of churches? Because I've seen in my life just how extraordinarily wonderful and important they can be in people's lives. And I've really felt the gap in my own life, you know, from becoming an atheist. So I've always been interested in that. And I think people can see that when they read this book.
Can we go through a couple of the important concepts that you talk about in this? First, the so-called the nocebo effect, right? The kind of evil twin of the placebo. What is that?
Okay, so I think that everyone knows what a placebo is, right? You think that something is going to help you or cure you, and it actually can. You can really see this in research into antidepressants, for example, which are, I mean, there's quite some evidence that they have some, like, how do you say that, real medical effect here. The question is obviously what is real, but a big part of the effect is a placebo. Now, that doesn't mean that antidepressants are, you know, not valuable. They're actually really valuable, but they really help people. But it also means that placebos are very powerful. And the interesting thing is that the more spectacular a placebo is, the more effective it is. So if I give you a pill and say, this is going to help you, that may be effective. But if I give you an injection, you know, that's probably going to be more effective because it's easier to believe that an injection is, I mean, that's really something that's happening. Now, one of the most powerful things you can do is to do surgery or fake surgery. Sham surgery is the term. And this is really, there's been really been research into this where they do procedures on people for like really nasty conditions like chronic back pain, for example. And they just pretend to do surgery on someone and then they don't do anything at all while people are in, asleep. And they wake up and they say, well, it was a resounding success and people feel much better. Now, that doesn't mean that it's fake or anything. It just means that the human brain is way more interesting than we often think. And that the whole medical process is way more interesting than we often think it is. Now, the opposite thing of a placebo is the nocebo, where a doctor says to you, well, you might experience side effects, and there you go. You already start feeling it, right? You might feel a little bit itchy here and there, right? So that can be a self-fulfilling prophecy as well. So in the book, I use this metaphor of a placebo and a nocebo, where what we believe comes to pass as a way to look at human nature as well. Because I think that our theories of human nature are often like that, that what you assume in other people is what you get out of them. If you assume that most people are selfish and nasty and that our civilization is only a thin veneer, then you'll create a society where you'll have institutions that just will bring out the worst in each and every one of us. And I think we can turn it around and have a society that doesn't work with a nocebo, but with a placebo view of human nature and tries to bring out the best in each and every one of us.
Yeah, it seems to me that racism often functions in that way, where you can, to try and explain that difference, where people who have very strong beliefs about other ethnic groups nonetheless can end up having, you know, they exempt a particular, you know, people that they know right? And therefore the those generalizations can coexist with the idea that actually on an individual level, you know, they don't have those beliefs in their everyday life, right? And they get together with people from different ethnicities. And I suppose that's part of that, what you're talking about the way that we tend to assume other people have, you know, we feel that things are true that aren't, because we feel that everyone else must think that, or, you know, we have beliefs that we don't really carry out in practice. Tell me about, I love this phrase, homo puffy.
Yeah, it's quite a controversial phrase in my book. Some people are like, are you serious about that? But no, it's the concept that I hope will make you famous.
It sounds like a very kind of banging club night. Yeah.
I hope it goes into the annals of science. Now, this is one of the most fascinating new theories from biology and evolutionary anthropology is the idea that human beings have evolved to be friendly. So the scientific term for this is self-domestication. I think we all know what domestication is, right? We've got cows and we've got goats and sheep. And these are animals that have been selected for tameness over the centuries and maybe even millennia by farmers and people who have animals. And the interesting thing is that domestication does very specific things to an animal. So there's a list of traits that you get with this so-called domestication syndrome. And biologists have known about this for a very long time. I mean, Darwin already observed this in the 19th century. So what do you get? Well, you get animals with thinner bones, smaller brains, and most importantly, they just look a little bit more childish or puppyish, if you will.
Lovely floppy ears, yeah, right?
Ears, very important. So that's domestication syndrome. And now, the really fascinating thing is that if you look at humans, if you look at us, we seem to be domesticated. But who did it, right? Who domesticated us? And the answer is we self-domesticated. So there's, I think, accumulating evidence that over the millennia, there was this process of survival of the friendliest, where actually the friendliest among us, the tamest among us, had the most kids and had the biggest chance of passing on their genes to the next generation. And this had a huge impact on our bodies. So if you compare Homo sapiens skeletons from 50,000 years ago to skeletons from 30 or 20 or 10,000 years ago, or to the way we look now, you see this puppification of humanity, right? You see that we've been domesticated. You see that we just look a little bit nicer in general. It's also, feminization is a very important part of self-domestication, is where you just, the men start looking more like the women. I don't think anyone should tell this to Jordan Peterson because he'll be quite shocked, but that is, I'm afraid, the direction in which the science points right now. So I've come up with a term for this, and this is homo puppy. Yeah, you can be the judge if that's a good term.
Do you know what will make you happy is that I went to a Jordan Peterson lecture before I interviewed him, and he did talk about, and something you talk about in your book actually, which is that the whites of the eyes in humans, we don't have dog's eyes, animals' eyes, you know, you can tell where we're looking. He introduced, I was sort of slightly nodding off a bit by that point, and he went, now I'm going to talk about the gaze. And I went, what? Are you sorry? And luckily it turned out he was in fact talking about where humans look rather than homosexuality, which might have been a more controversial route to go down. I just want to talk to you about that middle section of the book, which is concerned with debunking quite a lot of social psychology experiments. And, you know, there does seem to me to be a big crisis in social psychology where a discipline that is, you know, supposed to explain human nature has kind of succumbed to a, you know, this is what we think human nature is, and then let's work backwards and try and justify it. So which are the experiments that you think no longer stand up?
Well, after the Second World War, there was this new generation of young scientists, social psychologists, who were obviously thinking, how can we explain the Holocaust? How can we explain World War II? How can people behave in such horrible, monstrous ways? And what was very interesting about this moment is that there was this opportunity for very young researchers, like Stanley Milgram, for example, who was, I think, 28 years old at the time, or 29, very young. And they did these fascinating experiments that, you know, really have high viral potential. You see a video of it and you're like, holy shit, do people really behave like that? And it went really completely viral, 60s style. The other one was the Stanford Prison Experiment. It was a couple of years later, at the beginning of the 70s, done by Philip Zimbardo. Really interesting is that Stanley Milgram, who, by the way, did the shock machine experiments. I think that almost everyone will have heard about this. If not, Google shock machine Milgram and find the horrifying video on YouTube. And Milgram and Zimbardo were actually part of, in the same class in high school. Very interesting. Now, these experiments, I think sort of the point or the message of these experiments were, if you take perfectly normal, healthy, average human beings and you put them in an evil situation, then they very, very quickly turn into savages or monsters. So again, civilization is only a thin veneer, and deep down, or maybe not even that deep down, we're all monsters or Nazis. These experiments became incredibly famous, ended up in all the textbooks of psychology students, you know, dozens of documentaries were made about them, and Milgram and Zimbardo were super famous. I mean, Zimbardo is the most famous living psychologist today, draws huge crowds. But yeah, then the problem is that, especially in the case, by the way, of the Stanford Prison Experiment, it's like, what do you call it? Fake science? I mean, it's like we now know that, actually things happen in a very different way, because only now, 50 years later, the archives have opened up. And researchers have gone in there and discovered the real story, which was often pretty much the opposite of what we've always been told.
Right. And people were just basically felt they were kind of coerced into being, you know, they were very reluctant, the guards, to act kind of cruelly. Right. And there was a whole load of stuff specifically set up by the researchers in order to dehumanize the prisoners. And so people went along with what they thought they wanted the experiment to be. Right. This wasn't this great wellspring of cruelty that kind of gushed out of them. It actually revealed more about our desire for conformity and to sort of please people, I suppose, if you're going to talk about that. I want to bring you to what I think has been the most consistent criticism of the book, looking at the reaction to it. So you talk about these post-Second World War, you know, experiments that try to explain the Holocaust, right? The idea of after Auschwitz, everything is different. And whilst I agree with you that those experiments really took that conclusion and worked backwards, nonetheless, that is the fact is that humans are capable of great evil. What is your best guess as to why that is? If it isn't this veneer theory that we're all, you know, just 2 millimeters away from becoming savage and horrible to each other.
You know, one of the interesting things is that if you want to explain human niceness or friendliness, no one expects some kind of big theory, right? Because, I mean, it sort of makes sense. How did we ever conquer the globe if if we are not good at cooperating, then it does. Like, if we were really like the kids in Lord of the Flies, then why are we still here, right? But then you sometimes are in these interviews, especially for radio or television, and then after 3 minutes, like, the question is, yeah, but what about the Holocaust? How do you explain that? Yeah, what about that? Now, obviously, sort of, that is a huge question, and libraries full of books have been written about it. This is one of my main criticisms of these social psychology experiments, is that they sort of trivialize this horrible, cruel behavior. It's sort of like, oh, there's one relatively simple explanation, and that's why people behave in that way. While, I guess, for me as a historian, it's so important to point out that this was the result at the end of an incredibly complicated historical process in which evil was normalized and in which people started to believe that this savage behavior was somehow necessary or could be morally justified, right? But there are so many different parts of the explanation that you need. So, yes, in the book I have one chapter about why the Wehrmacht soldiers kept on fighting in 1944 and 1945 when it was clear that they were going to lose the war. You would assume, and this is what Allied psychologists assumed at the time, that they were brainwashed, right? That they were these fanatics who, yeah, were just fighting till the very end because they, I don't know, believed in the cause. Actually, what they later discovered, especially after interviewing lots of prisoners of war, is that many of these soldiers were fighting for their friends and for their comrades. That Kameradschaft was the really most important ingredient to let these soldiers keep on fighting. Now, obviously, that explanation doesn't work for the fanatical Gamp guards or the SS, high-ranking SS officers, etc. There you need a very different explanation. But what I do try to point out in the book is that very often we do the most horrible things, not in the name of sadism or because we enjoy being violent or anything like that. That's actually a very, very rare phenomenon. It does exist. I mean, there are some real sadists out there, but the Joker is not, I mean, that's really not human nature. Most people, when they commit violence or atrocities, they have to overcome, you know, very powerful instincts within themselves that actually go in the other direction. And they often do it in the name of the good cause or because they do it for their friends. That's not comforting. Actually, I think that's a very disturbing message that I talk about in my book. This dark side of friendliness. I think that would be part of it.
I thought that one of the things that screenwriting teaching teaches you is the idea you should write your villain thinks they're the hero in a different story, right? Which is this way. And I think that's one of the things that's interesting when you try and look at people do it. Very few people seem to do evil acts like sitting there in their volcano lair cackling, thinking, well, hey, I'm ruining some people's lives today.
There's also this British
sketch. Whether or not, for example,
I think it was Blackadder or something, where you have these two high-ranking Nazi soldiers.
Oh, it's Mitchell and Webb. Are we the baddies?
Yeah. Are we the baddies?
Right. Right. But I think that's a really useful insight, is that what happens is perhaps an ideology takes over to the point that people start to think, you know, God wants me to cleanse the earth of this people, or, you know, this terrible thing has to happen so that we can raise society and start again. And they are a kind of twisted kind of divine mission or ideological mission, right? It's very few people who do bad things do it because they think they're doing a bad thing.
You know, there was actually a little bit of a translation issue with the title of my book. Because in Dutch, and I originally wrote it in Dutch, the title is Most People Deugen, where deugen is a verb that you can't really translate. It's sort of, if you deug, then you are sort of good after all. But you're certainly not a hero. And I wouldn't even describe people who deug as good people. They're sort of, I don't know, they're not savages. And they want to be helpful and etc. They have feelings of empathy, etc. But that's not the same as being a hero. And I think this is the message that you have in your own book, Difficult Women. Which I, you know, after I read your book, I thought that I was wondering whether I should have emphasized that a bit more, because I only do it like in the epilogue. But that a lot of progress actually comes from people who are rather nasty and unfriendly and as you say, difficult, right? And that so often friendliness sort of stands in the way of progress. Because, you know, if you're at a birthday party and then your racist uncle starts going again, well, then maybe you have to sort of how do you say that in English? say something about it, and kick then it's off. not going to be a very friendly and nice party anymore.
That's one of the things I find most interesting, is to unpick the difference between, and this is unfair doing this to you in your second language, but kindness and niceness and compliance, right? And rightness, you know, and actually they're not always the same thing. Some, like, you know, in the sense of being, and parenting being an obvious example, right? Just giving your child everything that they want isn't actually kind. You're going to end up raising a monster. Actually, the kind thing is to set boundaries and limits. And that, in your racist uncle example, you know, do you prioritize your own comfort and the nice of the party over the larger social injustice of racism? Those are negotiations that we're all constantly making all the time. But you're right. And actually, the other strand of that, I guess, is also cooperation versus selfishness, which is, again, is not quite the same thing. Because it seemed to me that what you were mostly taking aim at in a political sense is that ideology that says, you know, the economic logic that says we're all out just to maximize our, you know, how much stuff we've got and how much we personally hold. And actually, I agree with you. I don't think most people do think like that. Most people don't want to be the only rich person in a wasteland. Mm-hmm. It's not very satisfying. Yeah.
And it's interesting that with theories of human nature is that something that is totally obvious when we think about our friends or our colleagues or when we think about ourselves, suddenly we forget that when we think about society in general. I experience this a lot when I talked about basic income to people, and you ask the question, well, what are you going to do with the basic income? And people have all kinds of wonderful ideas and dreams, and, well, I'm going to start a new company. I'm going to do this course into blah, 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 and etc. And then you ask the question, well, what will other people do? Well, my friends, I've heard they've got some dreams too, but most other people, you know, they'll waste it on drugs or alcohol, or whatever. So I guess that's the problem often.
We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared. So many great chats to enrich the mind, like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared. Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece, Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents. With the code SQUARED, simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable.
Universal basic income is, as you say, 6 years ago was seen as this crazy left-wing idea. Actually, now some people in Silicon Valley coming at it from a libertarian, you know, the robots are going to take all our jobs, so we need to make sure people don't, you know, revolt against us. I mean, I'm still, you know, I just wonder if it's progressive enough, actually, if giving everybody a flat rate, you know, actually, do I just want better benefits? But having, what I think is interesting about your work is that so much of it seems to be about shifting the window of what's possible and what's seen as being just idealistic and pie in the sky, right?
Yeah, exactly. So that is the process that has always fascinated me, how it's possible that, yeah, things that just a couple of years ago are seen as unrealistic or bizarre or unreasonable can somehow enter the mainstream. And, you know, what a fascinating moment was, I think, the beginning of April, this editorial in the Financial Times, where, you know, this is, what is it? The world's most influential business paper that said that we need to, quote, reverse the policy direction of the past 40 years. Think about a basic income, higher taxes on the rich, a Green New Deal, that we completely need to rethink, you know, the role of the state, not the state as some kind of facilitator of business, where sort of the state gives, you know, make sure that there's good infrastructure, people have Wi-Fi and, you know, a high quality education, but do much more, you know, in terms of research and social welfare and et cetera, et cetera. And I was like, is this real? Like, who wrote this? And I think it just shows you that indeed, there are some really interesting things that have been happening. And that is the process that has always fascinated me, sort of how that happens.
How are you getting on in your quest to make billionaires pay the same tax rate as you and me?
Well, this is another example where just, I think, 5-10 years ago, there wasn't much discussion around tax evasion. It's one of the paradoxes. This is true for the Black Lives Matter movement as well, is that the moment we get angry about something or there's a big movement and you sort of have the feeling, well, things are worse than ever, that in reality, that is actually the moment when things are improving. Because if you think about tax evasion, obviously 10 years ago, that was, in many ways, that was actually worse than it's now. We've made some progress since then. Switzerland, for example, used to be this tax paradise with bank secrecy. Well, that's gone. You know, it's the US and the FBI under that pressure. They just didn't last and now it's gone. And people said for decades, well, that will never be gone. That will always be the case. Switzerland will be this tax paradise with bank secrecy. Not the case anymore. So That is very counterintuitive that these movements from the past couple of months after the George Floyd killing. I mean, how many George Floyds have there been before George Floyd that didn't cause this huge peaceful outbreak of protest, right? How many have there been? Well, a lot. So that is sort of the thing that you got to try and wrap your head around, that even though, yes, we should be really, really angry and worried and not be optimistic at all. I mean, you don't have to be an optimist, but you can find some hope in the fact that actually these movements represent some genuine progress.
I did feel that when you have Elizabeth Warren, you know, doing a pretty serious presidential bid on the back of talking about taxing, you know, wealth taxes, you know, state taxes on these really huge multi-million pound piles of cash, you know, and talking about inequality, specifically in reducing inequality, I did think actually it has moved now from the, you know, those ideas are no longer laughable. I think they now do feel like they're kind of in, and I think Bernie Sanders did a lot, you know, to move those things into the American mainstream, right? And whatever you think about the, you know, his candidacy overall, you know, Joe Biden is now running on a platform that is significantly to the left. You know, whatever you think about Jeremy Corbyn's leadership of the Labour Party, the mood in Britain has turned against austerity, as evidenced by the fact that, you know, Boris Johnson's Conservative government says, you know, we're not doing that anymore, and is in the middle of giving away fistfuls of cash to anyone who wants to have a burger at a restaurant at the moment.
We live in this very strange period where it seems to me that left-wing political parties are not doing good at all, but left-wing political ideas are actually having quite a good time. It's a very strange, paradoxical situation. I mean, in the Netherlands, I can't imagine, you know, left-wing political parties getting a majority anytime soon. Actually, it's been declining. But then if you look sort of at the center of politics and sort of our climate policies, inequality, anti-poverty measures, the social welfare state, that used to be much more about what we call workfare, you know, where it's all about distrusting those who are on benefits and trying to force them to, you know, work more and work harder. That's really been going in the other direction. I mean, we're We're not nearly there yet, but I think the momentum is there. But if you would just look at the polls, you wouldn't really see it.
No, I think that's very true here as well. There was a Politico, I think, did an accounting of Ed Miliband's 2015 manifesto and then ticked off about 6 or 7 things from it, laughed at the time as being, oh, come on, what do you communists asking, you know, want now? And then have ended up being enacted, like a cap on energy prices, for example, energy bills, you know, which was kind of, you know, how terrible the state would, you know, presume to tell energy companies how much they can charge people. And then 5 years later, it's just happened. But why is that, though? Why aren't the left-wing party, you know, why are left-wing ideas getting more airtime, but the left, the institutions of the left aren't benefiting from that energy?
I've got a theory about it. I'm not really sure whether it's correct. But I think that if you want to go from the exciting idea that's moving into the mainstream to actually wielding political power, then at some point you have to make compromises and to build a movement that's bigger. That's what I loved about one of the first chapters in your book, where you talk about, you know, women's suffrage and how all these really difficult compromises had to be made between aristocrat women, you know, in high up in British society, and then working class women. And that actually many of these compromises didn't last for long, and that after a couple of years, they still hated each other. I guess that people on the right are often better at that, that they're just happy agreeing that those other people, they're the enemy, and we don't really care about our own differences. Where on the left, with progressives, it's often, you get this, what Freud called the narcissism of minor differences. This has always puzzled me, is that the people who hate me the most actually agree with me on 90% of all issues, or 98% of all issues, but just disagree with the way I, you know, a specific kind of concept I use, or think that I don't tweet enough about this, or that I tweet about this, but that I should also tweet about this, and I don't know, something like that. And I guess that happens a lot. And it's not really helpful if you want to build a bit broader movement. Maybe that's just me being annoyed at Twitter, because actually you could also argue that, I mean, in a way we're getting much better at building movements. Just look at these huge peaceful protest movements across the US, for example. But that's sort of my hunch. What do you think?
But I also think it's about being wedded to very old-fashioned ideas of left and right. Because I agree, I get the same thing. I get people telling me that I'm not lefty enough. And you kind of go, well, I actually would support 100% inheritance tax and free universal childcare for, you know, which would be a huge burden to impose on the state. But I think, as you know, many of the ideas in your book would actually ultimately pay off in huge productivity gains and huge amounts of particularly women being able to continue working at the level they were at before. And you think, but it so much becomes about, on the left, I think, about identity and a kind of competition of who's the best, who's the most pure. Whereas I think the right is a lot more like, we'd like to be in charge, please. Like, what are the mechanisms we... And therefore, you know, they talk about the kind of the Tory party being the, in Britain, being the longest running political party in the world. But it's done that by being incredibly, what's the kind way to put this, ideologically flexible. You know, the Conservative Party in Britain in 2020 is actually incredibly different, even in economic terms, from the one in 2010. Just absolutely miles, completely different in its position on Brexit, for example. But it's still got some fundamental principles, and it's still really, really committed to being in power. And I'm not sure that I always see that so much on the left. And what I think is the common strand between my book and your book is the kind of the idea that the best way to do politics is to say, to try and work out what we want. Like, here's the demand, and then who can I build? Who's with me? And that's a better way to work backwards from, like, what do I want?
Yeah.
How do I get
focus on the goal instead of the method or on the purity of the people you'd have to work with. I guess that would sort of be the right attitude. There are good examples of people who understand this. I recently wrote this essay about sort of what I call, maybe a bit prematurely, the end of neoliberalism, where I looked at two different groups of economists. On the one hand, you have this French trio of Thomas Piketty, and he became very famous with his book, Capital in the 21st Century, and his colleagues, Emmanuel Saez and Gabriel Zucman. Gabriel Zucman is hugely influential. I mean, on tax evasion, he's on so many very important publications just to show how big this phenomenon is. And then also you have this other group of female economists, where I think Mariana Mazzucato is the most important one. She's an American intelligence economist, incredibly productive, and wrote this hugely influential book, The Entrepreneurial State, where she shows that most fundamental innovations come from the government and not from the business sector. What I find most interesting about her is that she's a networker and an incredibly proactive networker. She's not interested in just writing a book. She wants to go to the World Economic Forum in Davos and speak to as many people as possible. And not like me, have like a 15 seconds of fame, but like have genuine influence, not just one viral moment, right? But just, yeah, talk about where are the billions of dollars and euros going to go next year. That is interesting. I think this, many of the sort of the economists behind the Green New Deal are sort of, I think this, maybe it's a little bit of, I'm maybe now making anecdotes into a bigger thing, a theory. But yeah, there are these sort of younger female economists who really want results.
Yeah, I think that Mariana Mazzucato book, I think, is incredibly influential. She has this thing about the fact that, you know, the majority of components in the iPhone are developed by, you know, like particularly through US defense money, but state money. So we have this whole idea about, wow, Apple should be allowed, you know, of course Apple should be allowed to have factories in China and shouldn't, you know, should pay favorable tax regimes because it's, you know, it's so productive. And yet the state is, you know, it relies entirely on the state to do that. And I think that happens at a micro level too. You know, I still think one of the most consequential political speeches in the last couple of years in America was that Elizabeth Warren, you know, nobody got rich on their own. And I think it was a way of expressing something very simply. You know, you took your goods to market on roads that we all built. You know, your workers are healthy because of because there is a public health system, at least in Britain. And that strain of thinking, I think, has become a lot more acceptable and popular. And as you say, partly due to the fact there are people willing to kind of come out and fight for it.
Maybe it's also accelerated by this crisis. What do you think? Because you recently had like all these governments around the globe publishing lists of the so-called essential workers. And I was thinking like this could be a sort of a defining moment for a whole generation. Everywhere in the news, there were these lists like the teachers and the nurses and the care workers. And you didn't see the bankers or the managers or the telemarketeers on them. So sometimes I wonder whether in the 80s or the 90s, there was a spirit like, okay, we had enough of the 60s. We just want to. We don't have like ideals or anything. We just want to make money. Let's get on with it, right? We are Generation Nothing, as it was called in the Netherlands in the 90s back then. But now that sort of that's not fashionable anymore. It's become much more fashionable to actually believe in something and to have a job that's actually of social value. So if you're young right now and you're thinking about what you want to study, I mean, are you really going to say at that birthday party, well, oh, I want to become a banker? Well, maybe you still want to, but maybe you still like the money, but you're not going to brag about it anymore, I think. So I was wondering whether the corona crisis could help to move us into a different era that is more about cooperation or solidarity or, yeah, sort of giving back.
I think one of the things that the coronavirus crisis to me seems to have done is reminded people of the fact that government is important. There's a really brilliant bit in Michael Lewis's book, The Fifth Risk, where he talks about both presidential handovers and also these awards that were created for people who worked in public sector in America. And he said it was, you know, it was really notable. The number of people who wanted to work in government jobs were first or second generation immigrants from countries where the state didn't work, you know, where they weren't complacent about the fact that you could switch on a tap and that water was drinkable. And I think that, to me, is the thing that I hope would most come out of this crisis, is people looking around and thinking, do I want to live in Germany or New Zealand or, you know, wherever it might be? Or do I want to live in a, you know, an aggressively capitalist country like America with very patchy social welfare net, or, you know, a very authoritarian country where I'm just, you know, I'm going to be told no one's dying, we don't need to take any action. And it's hard to look around and not see the importance of good government. I'm just going to turn us to questions now. We have one here from Eleanor in Cambridge. What is the antidote to cynicism?
Realism is the antidote to cynicism. You know, I think that often we humans, we are the stories that we tell ourselves. And for a very long time, we've been telling ourselves quite cynical stories. In the book, I give the example of Lord of the Flies. you know, the hugely famous novel about kids shipwrecking on an island, or, well, not actually shipwrecking. There's an airplane crash and then they end up on that island and they turn into savages. And millions of children around the globe up until this day still have to read it. I think it's a good book. I mean, it won a Nobel Prize for a reason. But then it would also be nice if people would know that actually the one time it really happened was in 1965 and 1966 near Tonga. Six kids shipwrecked on an island. And that was a very different story, because this was a story of friendship and survivorship and friendliness. I managed to track down some of these real live Lord of the Flies children, and they're friends up until this day. That's not a scientific experiment. It's just an anecdote. But anecdotes can be very important and influential sometimes. And the real Lord of the Flies is the opposite of the fictional one. So I guess that's sort of my response. What's the antidote to cynicism? Well, let's tell different kind of stories. Because these stories can become self-fulfilling prophecies.
Yeah, I feel that very strongly, that you get these kind of, I guess they're memes, really, in the old-fashioned sense of, like, the self-made man, right? So you have Donald Trump thinks he's a self-made man, and, oh, you discover actually what he had was a couple of million pounds from his father. So, you know, actually, you know, but because that's the mythology begins to, and every, you know, we have such confirmation bias that we just add to it and add to it and add to it, and you end up with these stories that look like
it's also a challenge as a writer, right? How important do you want the stories to be in your book? Because people remember stories. They forget all the statistics, but they remember the stories. I had this one story in my previous book, Utopia for Realists, where they gave free money to 9 homeless men in London, £3,000, completely unconditional. It was a quite successful experiment. Now, I believe that was the weakest sort of argument I made in my book, because it was an unscientific experiment. Like, just 9 men, what can you can't draw any conclusions out of that data. But I've actually been at a couple of, birthday parties where I was talking to people I had never met before, and they asked me, well, what do you do? And I say, I'm a writer. And so, what do you write for? And I say, I write for The Correspondent. Oh, never heard about that. So, have you written any books? Yeah, Utopia Free Is. Oh, didn't read it. So, what's about? Basic income. Giving people free money. Oh, that's interesting. You should look this up. There's been an experiment in London. It's actually, and I knew that they had read my article about it. But they had forgotten everything, right? Who I was, that, et cetera, et cetera. And that's so powerful about stories, even though they can obviously also be misleading. If you write about the story but not include the meta-analysis, then I think you've failed as a writer. But because that's I guess the trouble with some really good writers out there. And this is the trouble with some of my writing as well, that I fall in love with the stories and sort of forget that it's not the whole of reality.
No, I think it's a really hard thing to wrestle with, because there are kind of a couple of quite brutal jabs at Malcolm Gladwell, Jared Diamond in the book. And I've just been working on my current book, and there's something in there that I read and I went, oh no, there's a Malcolm Gladwell article about it where he's got to all the conclusions, but, and you know, actually he's kind of called it completely wrong, and it's too neat, and actually the real story is something much more complicated and interesting. And I thought that's, to me, is the problem with those books, is that they're too good as stories and everything is too neat, and anything kind of seems to get kind of brushed under the carpet. And then I thought, well, hang on a minute, do I do that too? And I'm sure you must have thought this too. I worried when I read the book, I thought, I wonder if the Christmas Day truce, which you mention in your book, I wonder if actually there were a couple of people bayoneting people in the background. Like, in order to keep that story pure, actually has that story been, like, even the stories that I like, have they been tidied up too?
I think actually the opposite is true, actually, for the Christmas truce thing, you know, because for years actually historians didn't pay any attention to it, and then the BBC in the 1980s, they were the first one to make a documentary about it, and for quite a while it was quite controversial, and you can still find articles on the internet where even sometimes professional historians say, well, it was actually a myth, it didn't really happen, and they didn't play soccer. Well, why is it a myth if you can find eyewitness accounts of people who've seen it, and not just one but multiple? I mean, there's some really powerful evidence that even these soccer matches did happen. Now, obviously, there's very powerful evidence that the First World War happened as well. So it's just like a very small ray of light in a sea of darkness. But it still gives you some hope.
Yeah, and I thought your quotation, the George Orwell one from the Spanish Civil War, about him refusing to shoot that guy who ran past him like holding his trousers up with both hands, I think that's such an interesting, because I thought, in that situation, even if that wasn't obviously, I was supposed to think that was a very bad person, presumably a fascist soldier, you kind of couldn't do it because you would see them instantly as a person, not as an enemy combatant. And I think that was very, I thought that was a very telling quotation.
Interesting here is that what sometimes happens is that someone comes up with a really interesting theory, but doesn't give the right evidence. So in this case, that was S.L.A. Marshall, the American combat historian, who, you know, traveled with the troops in 1944 and 1945, and was one of the first people to notice that many of the soldiers didn't actually shoot during combat and said that they couldn't do it and, you know, came up with some kind of excuse. Now, he was later criticized very strongly because, you know, he didn't really have statistics, or it seemed like more of a guess. And so many people now think that this whole phenomenon of soldiers not shooting during wars, that's just a myth, that actually we are born to kill and we quickly do that if we're drafted into the army. But I think that people are right when they say that Marshall didn't come up with convincing evidence, but it was an interesting hypothesis that he launched. And since then, many other people have actually come up with way more convincing evidence that I think show that he was at least 80-90% right. So that's sometimes also the problem with this debunking attitude, is that we sort of, that's been debunked. Well, actually, sometimes even debunking can be a little bit more nuanced as well.
Yeah. And I mean, I was just reading the memoir of Jason Fox, who's one of the SAS Who Dares Wins guys, who had to quit the army and had terrible PTSD because suddenly, you know, he killed someone in front of a child. And suddenly at that point, it snapped out of that video game frame of reference and began to sort of see things through as real life. And we now know the huge extent of post-traumatic trauma among soldiers, something that was just a huge taboo to talk about, which fits again into that thesis that humans find killing really, really hard. I'm going to ask you another question, which is, why are so many current leaders clearly not nice?
So the short summary of my book would be, most people are pretty decent, but power corrupts. That's sort of my getaway out of that question. So there's really powerful evidence now from psychology that power works like this drug that, I mean, damages the brain in a way. There's a research group in the US around Professor Dacher Keltner, who's done some really interesting work. His book is called The Power Paradox, where he shows that actually people prefer to have leaders who are friendly and nice. And often these people rise, you know, in the hierarchy. But then when they're at the top, this is the dark irony, they often become corrupted by power. There's even some evidence from neurology, which I think you still have to take with a little bit of salt, that it seems as if, yeah, the sort of the regions in the brain that are involved with feelings of empathy, they don't really light up anymore in powerful people, don't really seem to work that well anymore, as if they've become disconnected from society. They've become unplugged. Their Wi-Fi doesn't work anymore. They're sort of their social Wi-Fi. So I think that's a really important part of the explanation. But it's a terrible indictment of our sort of current political system. How is it possible that people who would have quickly been expelled in a hunter-gatherer environment, who wouldn't have survived for long, can now become president of the United States? How is it possible that we have this survival of the shameless process going on?
Yeah, I mean, my theory about that is that in some ways, I wonder if they're not the, you know, multi-drug resistant bacteria or viruses of our shaming culture. When you have a situation in which there's so much public shaming, it becomes a huge evolutionary advantage to be completely shameless and to be from the kind of identity group already, you know, primarily rich white men who can survive a shaming, at which point you become sort of weirdly indestructible.
Have you written that piece already? Because that there's so much truth in that. For me, it was one of the most fascinating discoveries while researching this book, is that human beings, that were pretty much the only animal in the whole animal kingdom who blush. Isn't that, I thought that was so fascinating. That I mean, bonobos don't blush, chimpanzees don't blush, but we do it. We involuntarily give away our feelings to someone else, you know, probably in order to establish trust. How can that ever be an evolutionary advantage? Well, the hypothesis that biologists have now is that, it helps to establish trust, so it helps people to cooperate. But then these people at the top, they seem to have lost the ability to blush, right? Maybe they become orange sometimes, but not really red, right? So that is such... I think that should be a good question, as if you're a political reporter and you're interviewing a politician, just ask the question, when was the last time you blushed? And how long they have to think about that, I think that tells you a lot.
That is a great, I'm noting that down. Which do you prefer, pessimism or optimism? And what are the advantages and disadvantages of the one you picked?
Well, I don't like either pessimism or optimism. I think they are both sort of forms of laziness. So the optimist is a little bit like, oh, things will turn out to be all right. Just look at the graphs. I recently read Hans Rosling's book or Steven Pinker's book. And actually, did you know that the world is in a great shape today? Child mortality is going down. So don't worry about racism or climate change. Actually, we live in the best of times. Well, I never really liked that attitude because I don't think it's helpful. And it's often, yeah, it makes people complacent. It's one of the things that I worry about the most actually right now with this book is that even though I do say this in my book, is that people are not naturally good and that actually we often do very nasty things in the name of friendliness, etc. I worry about the image of people, you know, on a holiday at a beach reading my book and feeling like, oh, you know, things are good after all. I don't really have to change my life or anything. Let's go get on with it. That's what I worry about.
I wouldn't be so worried about that as I would be about the opposite end, which is apathy induced by despair. And I think it's really interesting. I saw an interview with a climate change scientist who said something about, you know, something about emissions being really bad and, you know, we're looking at 2 degrees of warming, but that's something that we can change with our behavior. And I thought that's something that I would sort of counsel every climate scientist to include every time they do any kind of public statement, right? Because otherwise you just hear, you know, the world is on this one-way track to becoming a huge fiery box. And oh, well, like, screw it then, I'm going to use my SUV and, you know, like, we're all doomed. And I think that's, to me, that is the pessimism of sort of apathy is a bigger problem than the
complacency. I totally agree.
It's great.
David Wallace Wells made this point. You know, he wrote the book The Uninhabitable Earth, which is such an extraordinarily powerful book about climate change. I read it after I finished this book and I was like, I'm only going to write about climate change after this. Because I think that very often people on the right, they're naive about climate science, but people on the left are totally naive about climate action. They think that solar panels and windmills are going to save us. But I mean, it's just, we need to, sort of the kind of transformation that you need is so much more radical than people realize. And so he made the point somewhere, I can't remember where he says that, well, it doesn't seem as if there's enough fear or anything of this. And actually, fear can be a motivating force as well, especially if you combine it with hope, right? If you're really afraid of something, but then someone can give you hope, like we can actually do something. Well, I think that's what we need, not optimism or pessimism or anything like that. Just this classic distinction between optimism and hope. I've always liked that. And that's why the subtitle of my book is A Hopeful History, not an optimist history, but an hopeful history.
Yeah, but I do think you're right. I think that is one of the current problems of the left is an actual failure to engage with difficult choices. So climate change being an obvious example. I interviewed Caroline Lucas, who's the Green Party leader here, or was at the time, and, you know, saying, can we continue to have GDP growth in the way that we'd had it? Can we, you know, if in your vision in 25 years time, can I fly on holiday abroad? You know, can we still eat meat every day? And the answer to those questions realistically is no, unless something magical happens. But there's a kind of, as you say, I'm not wanting to kind of reckon with people. Yes, this is a soluble problem, but it's going to require quite big lifestyle changes for quite a lot of the planet.
You know, one of the bizarre things that has happened in that debate is that people now talk about climate mobilization as if mobilization is some kind of happy clappy thing where people come together and have a wonderful time. Well, if you actually study mobilization, for example, wartime mobilization, this is the analogy that people are drawing all the time, you know, the wartime mobilization in the US or in Britain during the Second World War. Well, it wasn't nice. It was actually a really hard top-down process, you know, when individual liberties were limited, when people had to pay a shitload of taxes, you know, rates that even people on the left will become nauseous when they see them, right? Like, well, you'll get your 100% inheritance tax. Don't worry about that. So, yeah, it's just sort of the kind of action that you need is way more than people think. And you'd also have to accept solutions that are not just not really comfortable, whether it's CO2 storage and capture, which is really controversial, or nuclear energy. I mean, I'm not one of those people who's obsessed with nuclear energy and thinks it's the solution to everything. But when you're in an emergency, you just need everything, right? You're not in a luxury position where you say, oh, well, we'll just have some solar panels here and some windmills there, but only if they don't destroy my nice view of this landscape here. No, obviously, you can't do that. You need everything, and you need to do it immediately. And this is another one of those examples where people who care about climate change need to become way more realistic about the importance of uncomfortable compromises and building a bigger movement to actually be serious about this.
I have one final quick question before I hand back to Hannah, which is this. If you can get everybody who's watching this to go away and do one thing, apart from buy the book, if they haven't bought the book already, obviously, what would it be?
Huh. Well, just ask yourself the question, what would it mean for my own life or the institutions that I'm a part of, you know, the school that I go to or the university or my workplace or whatever. I mean, people are in many ways shaped by their institutions. What are the implications of a different view of human nature? Because I think that's always the most interesting that you can accomplish as a writer, is that people take the ideas that you've taken from somewhere else, obviously, and they apply it in a different context. That's always what I'm most excited about, where sometimes you hear these stories, you know, on the other side of the globe, someone has, I don't know, started a new company or changed his or her life, and in a way that you could never have imagined. And what I strongly believe that once you change your view of human nature, so many things change in your own life. And I think that in my book, it's only like a short exploration of what the implications could be. And I'm very curious to see what other people will come up with.
Well, I hope that they do. And thank you, Rutger. The book is Humankind. Thank you to our audience. And thank you to Intelligence Squared.